and welcome to Worlds Apart. The US's behavior vis-a-vis other nations was never particularly subtle, reciprocal, or elegant. But given the country's preoccupation with domestic politics, many Americans could afford to ignore it. That is, until the arrival of Donald Trump. His swagger, while substantively not much different from the typical American way, now seems too much even for the US Supreme Court, which ruled last week that most of Trump's tariffs are illegal. What does it mean for the US's standing in the world and its relations with other nations? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Zichen Wang, Deputy Secretary General at the Center for China and Globalization. Mr. Wang, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, I'm sure this landmark US Supreme Court decision on tariffs didn't go unnoticed in Beijing. How was it taken?
I think in China, it was seen in two layers. Technically, it looked like, you know, the U.S. system is trying to put boundaries around one pathway the executive used for tariffs. But strategically, many Chinese observers don't read it as a, you know, quote, a return to normal trade rules. They see it as evidence of how politicized and fragmented U.S. trade governance has become. Congress, courts, and the White House pulling in different directions. And because, you know, U.S. presidents have multiple legal tools to raise barriers anyway, the decision doesn't automatically translate into some openness. As we saw, you know, shortly after the decision, President Trump, you know, levied a global tariff of 10%, and then maybe in less than 24 hours, he made it 15%. So I think the dominant takeaway in Beijing is this may change the form, but not necessarily the substance.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think this whole tariff campaign is a very interesting case study of not only American bare-knuckle tactics, but also of the various strategies that different nations have employed to deal with that. And many of these countries, particularly in Southeast Asia, chose to strike their own deals with Donald Trump. Do you think they may now have second thoughts about it?
Well, I just spent some time in Southeast Asia. I don't claim to be an expert on the region, but my takeaway from a week there was that, you know, they are hedging and they will hedge even more. It already lives in a world of competing pools, you know, U.S. security presence, China as a major trade partner, and the global supply chain shifts. If the U.S. tariff policy looks very unpredictable, you will see ASEAN members diversify, you know, export markets, deepen their, you know, inter-regional, intra-Asian trade, and use, you know, regional trade agreements more actively. Some will, you know, quietly seek carve-outs or sector deals with Washington, but few can afford, I would say, to align exclusively with one side. I think practically they will build optionality, more local value added, more diversified sourcing, and more diplomatic balancing.
Mm-hmm. Now, many observers have noted that Trump's somewhat intimidating style didn't work that well with China, which held its ground firmly. And many Western media are now reporting that the Supreme Court decision further undermines Trump's position before his upcoming visit to China. Do you agree with that?
I do think, you know, it reflects like the lack of consensus or division within the United States. And I mean, it embarrasses President Trump, and the fact that he has to go to social media and to, you know, try adding two additional global tariffs, citing a different legal instrument. I think that indeed causes problems for him. And I think from the Chinese perspective, the point is always to, you know, other than this, you know, specific percentages of tariffs, China wants to have a stable, a healthy China-U.S. relationship, to manage it well, to make it, you know, focus a little bit more on the cooperation side rather than the confrontation side.
Well, but Mr. Wang, I totally take your point that China wants a more sort of strategic relationship, a longer term to focus on policies, on issues. But you have a very unpredictable American leader who often acts out his own personal dynamics. And the question here is whether it is realistic, whether you can actually have, you know, a stable relationship with the United States at this point of time, and how you are going to ensure that stability.
China adapts with the United States as a country and as a system, not only one administration, but it adapts tactics to whoever is in power. Mm-hmm. Strategically, I think, you know, Beijing wants more cooperation, but it assumes the U.S. insists like the competition is the core part of the two countries' relations on tech, on security, on industrial policy. But technically, every administration has its style. With Trump, I think China expects transactional bargaining and the sudden moves. So it really cares about crisis management. And as you mentioned, you know, set clear red lines and, you know, Beijing officials don't go to Washington, D.C. to drop on his knees and beg for, you know, forgiveness or for a trade deal. And China also, you know, defends its interests, including utilizing whatever leverage it develops over these years. I think Beijing is prepared. And, with President Trump's reportedly upcoming visit to China in April, we'll see the more dynamics actually reportedly at the last day of March and the first 2 days of April.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a question about personalities, because it is pretty clear that President Trump seems to have a soft spot for strong masculine leadership, and President Xi definitely can be characterized as such a leader. He will definitely make into the history books for being able to change China both within and its position on the international stage. So there are reasons to be fascinated with his personality, but I wonder if this fascination is mutual. Is there anything in your view that the Chinese leader or the Chinese people find admiring or fascinating about Donald Trump?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I think on the leadership level, China tends to treat personal chemistry as secondary to interests. But it does value, you know, direct channels if they, you know, reduce misunderstanding. And secondly, I do think like President Trump has shown a level of respect to the Chinese leader. He has repeatedly said, on social media, on TV, you know, the Chinese leader is a very good friend of him. And I think Beijing got that message. And also, I think one very important point is that President Trump is not as ideological as his predecessors. So he wouldn't go on and criticize China on some of those value stuff. And I think this is actually something Beijing appreciates. And about the, you know, Chinese peoples, is there such a fascination about President Trump? I think he's seen as disruptive, unpredictable, but indeed endearing and, entertaining, you know, because he seems to just talk very, talk from his heart and sometimes doesn't think so much and doesn't clothe all his thoughts in this, you know, very philosophical, very, you know, nice words from the Ivy Leagues. And also, I think the Chinese people also understand he's quite risky because, you know, he's very capable of launching very abrupt and disruptive actions without, you know, much of a warning.
Well, speaking about conflictual dynamics, Chinese officials stressed on many occasions that trade wars serve neither the U.S.'s nor China's interest. And yet, at one point during last year's trade standoff, Washington and Beijing slapped reciprocal tariffs of more than 100% on some goods. How would you sum up the Chinese strategy in dealing with the United States at this point? And to be more specific, is it a strategy to deal with the United States or solely with the Trump administration?
I think the Chinese policy towards the United States overall, like strategically, it's being consistent. It wants peace. It wants, you know, economic interactions. It wants people-to-people exchanges. It wants to basically, since the U.S. is the leading power, the only superpower in the world, China wants to cultivate an external environment that's conducive to China's economic development, to its poverty elevation, to its development. So I think that remains unchanging. And I think China is sincere and genuine when it says there is a lot of room for cooperation. Mm-hmm. I think China also understands, you know, the competition is here to stay. And if it is to stay, and if the United States is going to adopt, quite hawkish and hostile policies, then the Chinese will basically not surrender and just stand firm and try to, you know, master its own options and, you know, leverage and even weaponize some of its options to defend its interests and to create pains for the United States. But ultimately, and I think this is one lesson maybe we have got from the so far the truce, the fragile peace between the two countries, it seems that both sides have developed their trade deterrents. Mm. And so that neither side would want or could afford to actually escalate any further.
Now, let me ask you one more question, because apart from the tariff issues, there are also many other aspects to the economic policies that the United States allows to itself but objects vigorously when it comes to China. For example, the operation of critical infrastructure like the Panama Canal or building mineral supply chains. Do you expect the Americans to change or perhaps challenge their own stance on those issues?
Well, I do think that this is, you know, the U.S. hegemony and its own, you know, a sphere of influence is going to be an increasingly a larger friction point between China and the United States, because, you know, it's a Hong Kong-based publicly traded company, which is, you know, under, you know, having gone through all the necessary
but,
legal procedures.
Mr. Wang, with all due respect, I don't think, I mean, I agree those are all legitimate arguments, but I don't think they matter for Donald Trump simply because he doesn't like it. And for him, the fact that he doesn't like it or that the Americans don't like it, for them, that's big enough of an argument. So let's skip all this legislative talk that you can, leave for other law-abiding nations. But I think when it comes to him, do you think they are likely to sort of move towards that realm where they treat others the way they treat themselves?
The United States has been accustomed to be the number one, to be the hegemony, to be the unquestioned leader of the world. And now it is insisting it must retain, you know, remain dominant, at least in its part of the world. And in its, you know, it captured the leader of Venezuela, and it is threatening Cuba, and it is now pushing, you know, South American countries and, you know, threatening, you know, Chinese legitimate just commercial interests over there. So that could potentially create a challenge for, you know, the relatively stable China-U.S. relations at this point, because, as you said, China has some, you know, mining investment there and some port investment there with no military presence and barely any, you know, security part of those involvements. But if the U.S. just becomes so paranoid and, you know, about even these commercial engagements, then if they, you know, truly push the South American countries to, for example, kick out Chinese businesses, civilian businesses, then I think Beijing will have to defend its interests with finding some other means as well.
Well, Mr. Wang, let's take a very short break right now. We will be back to this conversation in a few moments. Stay tuned.
I've spent years in conversations beyond borders. Some were formal, some tense, some difficult. But all of them mattered. They charted India's path and how the world responded. Foreign policy isn't theory, it is lived. In arguments, in decisions, and in their consequences. It's not an interview, it's a conversation. Let's talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Zichen Wang, Deputy Secretary General at the Center for China and Globalization. Mr. Wang, just before the break, we were discussing the strategy that China employs in dealing with Donald Trump, which includes both, you know, strategic thinking, realizing its own strengths and sometimes instrumentalizing those strengths. And just before the break, you said that if the United States were to move paranoically to try to push China out of, let's say, some of its investments in South America, then China would have to move or perhaps act in a different way. What exactly do you have in mind? And let me just preface my question by saying that I think many countries at this point of time are still trying to placate Donald Trump, right? To placate the Americans and deal with them as they are. But ultimately, it does raise a question of the international law. And if we all want to have the same, you know, level playing field and predictability and reliability in our relations, then there should be some rules that apply to all, rather than all of us trying to sort of walk around this crazy leadership in Washington while it does whatever it wants. So what means do you think China may employ when, if and when its strategic interests are threatened?
Well, I think, for example, I think China has its own leverage. So people have talked about critical minerals. Basically, China has quite a big dominance in rare earth that has been proven very effective in bringing, you know, Washington back to the negotiating table. And but China also has other tools, you know. Basically, I think for a lot of part, actually, China learned from the United States in weaponizing, you know, trade and, you know, export controls and these investment related restrictions. And I think also diplomatically, you know, leaders of traditional allies of the United States are coming to China. Actually, as we speak today, the German chancellor is in town, and after, you know, quite some other European leaders here. And I think China is welcoming more and more international cooperation. And many other countries, when they see the United States acting like this, they will want to hedge a bit more. They want to, you know, interact with China more. There is a limit to the power of the United States. And I'm pretty sure, like, the countries in Latin America, in that part of the world, and also everywhere in the world, they will make their own decisions. They will not just submit very easily to U.S. pressure. They will also think about, you know, how to treat in China as well as, you know, the international rules and norms with respect, and then how to arrive at a you know, outcome which is not just becoming the, you know, the just listening to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have heard this opinion becoming more and more popular that the Supreme Court decision indirectly may benefit China precisely because of the reliability and predictability that China can offer in comparison to the United States. But that, again, raises a question of China's own rise and this sort of the fear, somewhat paranoid fear of China becoming the new hegemon, and not just the new hegemon, but somebody who is going to coerce and treat others unfairly. Even though I'm not sure it's actually possible after everything that the world has endured from the West, that you can get to, you know, heights of unfairness that are beyond that. But what do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I think a true unipolar moment is very hard to reproduce. The world is too networked, too technologically diffused, and too economically interdependent. Even the U.S. at its peak depended on alliances and open trade. I think today the fragmentation is deeper. And China is certainly a major pole, but hegemony implies both capability and willingness to provide, you know, global public goods and enforce rules, often at a very high cost. I think China's stated preference is a more multipolar order with stronger, you know, the centrality of the United Nations, not replacing one unipolar power with another. And secondly, and I think this is actually very important, is, you know, China is as big it is as the second largest economy, but its GDP per capita is still $13,000. That only actually ranks about the number 70th in the world. It's both stated and it's the mission of the Chinese leadership, the Communist Party of China, and the Chinese government to focus on its own internal matters, to make lives better for its people. And that's what, you know, keeps the Chinese leaders awake at night. And they don't want to go out and, you know, conquer the world and, you know, set up military bases across the world. That's not in the Chinese plan.
Those who have studied the rise of China would probably agree that it's a story of incremental systemic development. It's a result of very meticulous, thoughtful planning and the hard work of several generations. And this is not something that many societies or many political systems can pull off these days. My question to you is, do you think Western nations, particularly the Americans, are still capable of such a systemic endeavor, you know, making a plan, a growth plan for themselves and actually implementing it?
Well, I think different countries and different people have their, you know, respective way of development. And the Chinese, from the reform and opening up in the 1978 until now, you know, almost 50 years, it has proven by all accounts, everyone in the world is pretty successful. So China combines, you know, long horizon planning, policy experimentation, and, you know, strong state capacity to build infrastructure and mobilize resources. Western systems, they have their own way, and they have a, you know, they've spend more time on building their economy and doing trade. And by and large, I think, including the United States, if you measure it by wealth, by income, by living standards, it's at a pretty high level. But I do think there is a bigger worry, not from just outsiders like, you know, us or, you know, other country foreigners' observation, but also from within the United States, that there is this fragmentation, there is this, you know, domestic a lack of capacity to change. The United States has, you know, as every country on earth does, have so many internal challenges, but its political system so far seems to be completely incapable of overcoming them, whether it's gun control or, you know, ensuring health insurance for its vast 350 million citizens, despite it is the wealthiest nation on earth. You know, I spent a year in the United States between July 2024 and June 2025 as a mid-career graduate student at in New Jersey. And I do like the United States, and it pains me to say that the country is stagnating on some of the issues, I think. And I think many people in the world, including in the United States, actually wanted to have it repaired. But so far, we're not seeing much progress on that.
But Mr. Wang, this is not a question of personal likes or dislikes. I also spend a lot of time in the United States. I like the country. But it's ultimately a political and policy question whether Western systems, not Western societies, but Western systems can compete on a level playing field without exploitation, without expropriation of resources, and without, you know, this psychological manipulation of telling other nations that you need to change yourself so that we can be competitive, or rather that we can stay on top of you. Do you believe that the political systems as they stand right now, without being reformed, that they can actually compete fairly with others?
Well, I do think, like, for example, the political system, how it works is, at the end of the day, decided by the voters at their polling booths. And if that is what the people of the United States choose, then that this is the government, the result they get. And I don't think, you know, I don't think there is a one best development path or form of government or form of, you know, political culture that's suitable for everyone in the world. And I think, you know, even the Chinese government officially doesn't believe that. I think the Chinese generally believe different peoples have their own way to choose their policy path. And but the challenges you are describing, the stagnation you are describing, I think they are real.
Mm-hmm. Now, George H.W. Bush used to say that the Americans in their, you know, earlier, more glorious years were hated because of their way of life. I wonder if the same perhaps applies to China as well. You're not being hated, but don't you think that you're being prejudiced because of your way of life, because of who you are and how you manage your challenges?
I think there is prejudice in how China is sometimes discussed, often a tendency to treat its system as, you know, inherently illegitimate rather than simply different, and to assume intentions from ideology alone. But I think we should be fair. You know, China has its own enormous challenges, you know, domestically, which deserve serious debate and criticism. But the problem is when debate becomes essentialism, China does X, you know, just because it's China, which shuts down analysis. I think a healthier approach is, you know, what are the incentives? What are the facts? What are the trade-offs? And where, you know, interests align despite the differences. And I think China is a huge country of 1.4 billion people. It actually has much more diversity than many Westerners perceive. And there are, you know, just very interesting dynamics. China also has politics, you know, different government departments compete for attention, for resources. And but a lot of that is just folded under the symbol of, you know, state control or, you know, communism.
Mm-hmm. And despite its sometimes hostile rhetoric, the Americans also seem to be interested in some of the policies that China or Russia, for that matter, have employed quite successfully. For example, self-sufficiency or self-reliance in critical manufacturing or in securing their own mineral resource base. The Trump administration officials nowadays often talk about that I need to do something similar. Do you find this encouraging?
I do think like a certain level of reindustrialization of, you know, developing its own manufacturing at home in this huge country of 300 million and 350 million people, that's legitimate. And, you know, you can't have all your economy based on finance and services. And so if you define it as resilience and a less fragile supply chains, more domestic capability in critical sectors, I think it's encouraging. But if it becomes autarky, it's costly and destabilizing. And many countries will have to copy the logic, de-risking industrial policies, strategic reserves, without copying the extremes. I think that the key point is the policy implemented by the current administration in the United States is it's going to be ineffective. You can't just use, you know, tariffs to force you know, companies to move their manufacturing into the United States. That could be one of your tools, calibrated with other tools to, you know, build more bridges and roads and train more talent, encourage more people to join the workforce. It has to be a bit of everything. It's a policy mix. It's not that, you know, just tariff people. That doesn't work. And even if for Trump administration to reach its goals, it needs to be a policy course that's studied, that's, you know, empirically studied and, you know, implemented meticulously.
Well, you know, Mr. Wang, as the Americans like to say, if the only thing you know is a nail, then everything becomes a hammer. And I think that fits your description of the Trump administration's policies, although I do hope that perhaps he watches this interview ahead of his visit to China, because you just laid out a couple of great ideas for the American administration of how to be more competitive and on a level playing field with your own country.
And I think, if I may interrupt, actually in their implementation of a better policy package, they do have more, you know, opportunities with not just China, but also with the rest of the world. You know, imagine if the Chinese can help build infrastructure in the United States, it will improve efficiency and, you know, cut costs tremendously. And as China goes through a real estate crisis, a lot of construction firms and the workers are out of jobs. And of course, this is like politically not going to happen. And but, you know, for other, you know, policy tools that the U.S. can implement, they will create opportunities and, you know, mutually beneficial opportunities between the U.S. and with many of the other countries in the world.
Well, they will have to do that homework themselves. We have to leave it here. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
And thank you for watching. See you next week on Worlds Apart.